Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 13th, 1998. And in the fireside room this evening, we have Paul Olson. And he will be talking about literature. And this session, number three, will be about entitled Me Tarzan, You Jane, Stick to the Role. It's dramatic readings of poetry and fiction and discussion of the effects of literature on us. Do women react differently than men? Can great literary art transcend gender, racial, and religious differences? And this is OLP 98-3. And now let's go to the fireside room for the discussion and lecture.
This is a session called, Can Literature Transcend Difference? Me, Tarzan, You, Jane, Stick to the Role was the crazy title for it all. I've taken my cue on that title, or that idea, from three different places, and I'd like to share those with you. They're all pretty short, one is a little bit longer. The 16th and 17th century English poet and theologian John Donne, in a famous essay then called No Man is an Island, I read it now like this, or part of it. No one is an island entire of itself. Everyone is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the lesser, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of the friends or time or thine own were. Any person's death diminishes me, because I am involved in all of humankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Again, no one is an island entire of itself. Another one is William Faulkner's great speech, acceptance of the Nobel Prize in 1951, in which he, I'm summarizing now, he saw the work of a poet, and he means all writers, is to create out of the materials of the human spirit something which did not exist before. And my point in using that is that he has no sense of gender or of difference at all, but to create out of the wealth of the human experience something which did not exist before. And then finally, from what I think is one of the great essays of the 20th century, James Baldwin's book, and I'm pushing it now, it's in the bookstore, The Fire Next Time, in which he says, the purpose of God is to make us larger, freer, and more loving. And then goes on to attack the Christian church as it's behaved throughout its history. Because the church hasn't made us larger, freer, and more loving. So with that in mind, I'm just going to share some different kinds of literature and let you respond to them. And respond, as I tell my students, I think that literary criticism, or our first response, literary criticism starts in the guts, not in the head. And we want it to start in the head, and then that's why we don't talk in class, and I got to think of something good to say here. And that's a mistake, because art isn't meant to do that. It gets there eventually, because it includes all of our being, but I think it starts in our guts. Here's a poem that now specifically, that I guess I created this title from, Me, Tarzan, You, Jane. And I'm going to ask some questions about this poem. It's a little quiz, and if you fail it, you don't get breakfast tomorrow. on Gwendolyn Brooks's wonderful poem called The Mother. And this poem is about abortion. And she doesn't take a political or a religious stand. She just renders an experience. And maybe I'll say something more to introduce this. That one of the things that literature does, that the poetry and fiction and good essays, that all great literature does, is that it gives us, maybe this is the most important thing of all. I'm speaking to the poet in the audience, and I shouldn't be telling her what it is. But I think what matters most are images. What are those concrete pictures that about which there can be no debate? We can debate friendliness and love and anger, but we can't debate a clenched fist. I mean, that's a specific concrete image. And great poetry and great fiction carries its load through the images. Well, you're going to have images in this poem by Gwendolyn Brooks. And I guess I'd like to have you, if you don't mind, close your eyes while I read this poem. And just let these images filter through your brain and course through your blood and through your heart and your guts. Everybody's eyes closed? That's part of the quiz. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers who never handled the air. You'll never neglect them or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them controlling your luscious sigh in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, if I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. But why should I whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead, or instead, you were never made, but that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled, or planned, or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly, and I loved you, all. Wake up. No commentary from me, but from you. That's one commentary in itself, your silence. I thought of handing this out. I have several copies, and I thought, no, I'm going to let the images work without having, you don't have any reference to go back to. What images do you remember?
Hearing their voices in the wind.
Voices in the wind. More.
Giggles.
Pulps.
Mother's gobbling eye.
A mother's gobbling eye. That's a poet speaking who just gave that image. And you set me up for the whole discussion, Erica. Thank you. You are not a mother, are you? And that's the image that she remembers. Do you have to be a mother to imagine a mother's gobbling eye? Those of you who are mothers, what does that mean? I'll ask those who aren't mothers too, but those of you who are, what's a mother's gobbling eye?
The delight you get from watching your children do things.
Yep. You watch them do things. Fathers, what's a mother's gobbling eye? Is it any different?
Yes.
Do you put, what?
Yes.
What is it? You don't delight.
I'm thinking that the mother catches everything.
Okay. It's a mother speaking in this, and the mother's gobbling eye, maybe a mother catches more. Good point.
She loved. More than, you know.
How do you, How do you know, I mean, that's the abstract word. I mean, you're right, it's a great one. She loved, I'm putting it over here because it's not really an image. But how do you know, what image does convey to you that she loved these unborn kids?
She knows what they might have been, and she knows what she gave away.
This, yes, a little juice here. The specific... imaginative images. What I've written there, the specific imaginative images are images of love. Wind up the sucking thumb. Don't suck that thumb. Return for a snack of them. How many of you, men and women, put that kid to bed, put her down, put him down, walk out, go back and, because they've been a rotten kid all day, and then, they're so innocent, and it's so great to look at them right now, and I just want to watch them when they sleep, and I hope I don't ever even see them tomorrow. Sneak away with them and come back with a luscious sigh, return for a snack of them. Those are the images, and so you come up, as a good reader would, with, that's about love. Anything else? Does anybody, you will as I ask you, remember the image, breasts they could never suck? Write it down. What's that image do? There's an abstraction for you. That's a specific image. We can, a breast is a physical thing. Believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate.
Yeah.
It's a finite act. The fetus is gone. That's the finite / deliberate. But the act itself, the motivation for the act, how many of you were sure of the college you went to, or were sure about coming to Holden, were sure about taking this job or moving on from this place to that place, or were sure about believe even in my deliberateness? Because the act, when you finally pick your college, this is the example I use with kids, you finally pick your college, it ain't St. Olaf, it's Luther. And I'm sorry, you can't go to both at the same time, but you end up at St. Olaf and there you are, and even in my deliberateness, and then the act is there. You have no other alternatives anymore. I was not deliberate. Is that love? I don't know, but what else is it? What do you respond to? Or what do you come up with?
Cowardice.
What?
Cowardice.
Wow, never thought of it. Cowardice. Explain it.
Well, it sounds like she found herself in a situation that she didn't want to be in. So, out of cowardice, she ended the child.
Are there other images that suggest that that's her motivation? I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm asking you, that's how we explore poetry and how we explore our abstract assessments of that. Love is one assessment, cowardice is another. And then what images lead us to these determinations? And one of the things we look at, and it's, I think it's one of the purposes of using this session, the way we use it, that is, can art transcend difference, is that we have to be aware of what we bring to a poem as well, what we bring to a piece of literature too. And I suspect that someone who has had an abortion looks at this poem very differently than someone who hasn't. Next Wednesday, this is an advertisement, folks, I have a poetry show. It's a one-man play, and I do a bunch of poems in that, and this is one of them, and that'll be there. And the first time I ever did that in front of a college faculty at Augustana, I knew most of the people in the audience, and a faculty person who was absolutely against abortion under any circumstances came up to me and said, "Where did you get that poem? I want a copy of it. That is exactly where I stand on abortion." Not 5 minutes later, a woman who is, I don't like these political terms, is pro-choice, came up and said, "Where did you get that poem? That is exactly where I stand on abortion, and I got to have a copy of it." My point is only to suggest that what we bring to the poem is part of that poetic experience as well.
Well,
I was listening all the way through for any hint of what her motivation had been, and I did not find that in my experience of it.
Okay, we'll go like this, motivation none. But what, so what did she feel? Or what did you feel? You don't know her motivation, but what do you know about this speaker?
Loss.
This is a poem about loss. It's a poem about
remorse.
It's a poem about grief. It's a poem about.
What I was just going to say, the purpose for termination could have been anything. I mean, maybe if the child wasn't going to live, and it's just telling what's happened since then. It's not saying how she got there. It's when she was there and what happened since.
She must have had another child to know specifically all about those feelings.
Yeah. It seems like she should have to have been a mother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, now we're transcending difference, and that's what this is about. Is that do you have to be? You're not. That's the image that Erica picked out. The mother's gobbling that she's not a mother. And good poem?
Yeah.
Okay, but say what you were going to say.
Yeah. I'm an aunt. But I don't know how many times my niece and nephew have said, what are you looking at? I mean, I'm gobbling whatever I can. I usually hope they're not looking. Yeah. I mean, that they're not always seeing me looking at them, but sometimes I'm just, wow.
Good.
I can't.
Good. Thank you. That's a
There's almost, in that one section you just talked about, there's almost a hint of rationalization. Mm-hmm. Read that one line again you just talked about. There's almost a hint of the deliberateness. It was, but it wasn't. Almost a hint of trying to rationalize what she's done, possibly.
Another one of the.
I don't know. It was, but it wasn't.
One of the assessments of it, if it comes from that. But what you're doing, and no matter what word here we pick, we're coming from our guts. And then as we explore what those gut reactions are, our intellect takes over or works together with our guts, and that's all part of that experience. Anybody else?
But why did she abort her babies if she knew that she was going to have these feelings?
I don't know. It's a great question. And so then we ask, go ahead.
Well, I had a spontaneous abortion. It wasn't a planned one. And I grieved for about a year. But neither my husband or my brother, who was visiting me then, I think they thought I must be a depressive person. Hmm. So I really didn't talk to anyone about it, but I just used to cry walking down the country road afterwards. And it isn't all abortion.
Yeah.
It's not intentional.
Yeah. Abortions will not let you forget. Hmm. My wife, who was here, is a hospital chaplain and talks to people who have miscarriages, and it's usually just kind of shoved off as, okay, you'll have another one and just work on it, you know. It's a serious grief, no?
Oh, sure. No. I had a miscarriage, first one. And we, for years, we talked about our first child. Mm-hmm. You know, what our first child would have been.
The first child that wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And I think there's a lot of people who struggle with being able to have children at all. And I think a lot of those same emotions, not being able to look at and not being able to experience some of those things for women who can't have children. Kind of would go along that same way.
Sure.
Those grieving feelings.
That's really great stuff. In this poem, is it accidental?
No.
I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts that could never suck. I have said sweets if I sinned. What do you do with that? Sweets. If I sinned. This is no social, not just the social response. This is theological. Sweets. If I sinned. If I stole your births and your names, that's social, that's family, that's relational. If I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your aunt, well, I mean, this is a big deal. But she contracted. Well.
But that could, I mean, if, it could also have been a spontaneous thing that happens in your 20s because of choices that you made in your late teens. I mean, that still, the contract still starts when you did whatever the first activity was. Some sporting thing that was whatever. I mean, I don't know these things. But still, I guess what that says to me is, as someone who has no children, somewhere along the line, some choice was made that's the result. And it's a different one than this, but I love children a lot. And somewhere there was a choice. So it doesn't necessarily mean that her choice was during that 9 months.
Yeah. That's good. I never thought of that. Good. Thank you. Anybody else? Well, here's the tough question for me to ask. How many of you, while I was reading that, thought or paid attention to the fact that I'm a man? Not one of you? With lines like a mother's gobbling eye and breasts they could never suck, and not one of you thought that what's happened to us?
I did think, now the fathers of young babies that have been around here in the last 3 weeks, I think they gobble with their eyes as much as the mother did.
Yeah. Well, I think I did. I mean, when my kids were around in my home. But my point in asking that question, I had no idea. Well, I had some idea, I guess, or I wouldn't try to do that poem in a dramatization. But nobody, smart people, educated people, sensitive people, gave that a thought. What does that say? Me, Tarzan, you, Jane, stick to the role. And my question then is, does art transcend difference? Mm. And listen to what Faulkner said in his great Nobel acceptance speech. The job of a writer is to create out of the materials of the human spirit something which did not exist before. What exists, and I will go on to some more literature now, what exists for us that didn't before from having experienced this poem? What do you have that you didn't have 10 minutes ago?
The view of someone who has had an abortion.
Yeah.
Looking back.
I'm going to write it down because it's a great word, but we're going to find more. The view of someone who's had an abortion. What else besides the view of someone who's had an abortion?
I think maybe for some of the women in here, it makes us think back to either having childbirth, or again, the fact that we can't have children. And I guess maybe that's where I'm coming from. I can't have children. And this kind of thing, okay, am I missing something? You know, and maybe that's kind of what this poem has done for me. It just got me thinking, I made choices, which was cool. But it kind of gets you thinking reflective, kind of, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Our own experience, whatever.
I would contend also that great literature isn't just about an experience. You're right, you're dead right. It's a view of this person, and it's about that. But it is also not only, and I'll say it clearer now, it is not just about an experience, it is an experience. Is that true with this poem? That you experienced something that you didn't experience before?
Absolutely. Yeah, compassion. Yeah. I mean, when people listed who they were and I put compassionate, I mean, absolutely, I felt like
something that did not
sad.
Exist before. What? And sadness. I mean, you felt sad before and you felt compassion before, but not in this situation.
In that quote that you gave, you talked about the human experience, the quote about, tell me that
Faulkner?
Faulkner's call. He said it touches the human experience. And human experience isn't male or female, or mother or father or aunt or what, or single person. It's human experience, and the human experience of a journey and reflection and pain, no matter if it's an abortion or something else, that's all of us.
Yeah.
That's the human experience of something bigger.
Here's Baldwin. Read it. It's a great essay. The Fire Next Time. The purpose of God is to make us larger, freer. And then his last phrase, more loving. And if to take out of the materials of the human spirit and create something which did not exist before, we've all felt compassion and sadness before. Never in this context. Never for this person. And somehow there's a connection there. And it was all done by just a bunch of words put together by somebody who could think real well and use a great imagination. And one of the things I thought of just now while I was listening to your answers is that when William Styron, I mentioned that earlier, was at our campus, he said to us, the thousands of people in the audience, putting his hands on his chest, Sophie. How many people have read Sophie's Choice or are reading it? Okay, you know who Stingo is then? Stingo is the male narrator, and all of Sophie's stories come through him. He didn't say, Stingo is me. This white male southern writer said, Sophie is me. Read the book, and there'll be no doubt that he had to be so in tune with what made her tick that he could create.
I was just curious if anybody in reading it and the imagery became the child, the object of the mother's godlike eye. Mm. And a question,
great question,
of not being.
I had a feeling, I don't even know how to explain it, but there are so many children that are living that don't experience like that. You know, don't experience the love of their mother. There's so many young children that are left
to father. Loved, blessed, and disaborted.
Yeah.
Fears. Wow. Well, answer, Eric, anybody think of themselves as the singer or the worker who never handles the air?
Did you think of that, Eric?
Yeah, I do. Just because if I recall my own childhood, I remember that feeling, that sense of being watched, that sense of the person caring. I hope we've all here felt it, of that caring, and then and then I've seen myself do it with people I care about, not just children. But that makes me wonder too of our image of a woman who would choose to have an abortion, if we look at that, or any child who is unloved, it makes me question if that's a valid opinion to have.
Some just abort motherhood, not the baby.
Some what?
Abort motherhood and not the baby. I mean, the baby lives and comes into the world.
Oh, oh, oh.
Motherhood doesn't happen.
Maybe they have goblin eyes for other people's children.
Well, listen to what you're saying, all of you, that comes out of the power of poetic language. Not to sound like an English teacher or anything like that. well, let's move on with some others. When I put this together, I thought, you know, what's the best way to see, to experience some kind of transcendence, or somehow to move us out of our own sense of self into a broader sense? And Karen Wee is a published poet and a longtime Holdenite. Writes a poem about her lesbian daughter. And it's called Coming Out. And I'll let you respond to it again. It's clear what it's about, but she says, I mean, the title of this section is called Coming Out, and all of the poems in that section are about the world's response, both personal and social, to homosexuality. This one's called Coming Out. All over town, crabapple trees have come out, blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. People have noticed, yet no one can account for it. So some have begun to consult the specialists. Others hold that an early frost last spring set the trees on a different course. But in any event, it is nature. True nature at her surprisingest. The way I see it, the only thing to do is to sit back, enjoy or get out of the way of their blooming in our front yards, along roadways, and in the far distance. But I would urge you to stop long enough to attend closely their beauty, their fragileness of flower. Study the blooms and tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us as most other Midwestern trees turn gray. Once again, no commentary from me, but I'll read again if you want me to.
I'd like you to read it again.
The metaphor, of course, is these trees are coming out at the wrong time, and it isn't just quite right. It doesn't seem natural, so they're going to seek explanations for that. You know, we're going to, what does she say? consult specialists, and then come up with all kinds of theories. Well, here it is then. All over town, crabapple trees have come out, blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. People have noticed, yet no one can account for it, so some have begun to consult the specialists. Others hold that an early frost last spring set the trees on a different course. But in any event, it is nature, true nature at her surprisingest. The way I see it, the only thing to do is sit back, enjoy or get out of the way of their blooming in our front yards, along roadways, and in the far distance. But I would urge you to stop long enough to attend closely their beauty, the fragileness of flower. Study the blooms and tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us as most other Midwestern trees turn gray. We know what it's about. What's the experience of the poem that we have just hearing it?
We journey with her as she comes to an acceptance. At first she's surprised, then realizes, okay, and she has a choice, either to accept or get out of the way.
Or accept, get out of the way, or stop. And pay attention, close attention to that.
Yeah.
But I like your words, so I wrote it down. We experience a journey, part of the human. And what do you do, and you don't have to give a social or religious or political stance on this, but just paying attention to this poem, what do you do with the journey of this speaker, or the journey that you had just now hearing this poem? What do you do with that?
Give them space.
Whose space? The
people.
The trees.
In that situation.
Yeah.
And not be judgmental and just be kind of supportive.
Yeah. So because of this journey, had you ever? And I don't. I'm not asking you this question. Have we ever been on this journey before? To create out of the materials of the human spirit something which did not exist before. Is there a connection to somebody that we didn't have before? Do we look at that fragile bud differently than we did before? Listen to her in another one.
One of the things in that, I have the sense is that the crabapple tree will be a crabapple tree forever, but this blooming is the only time it's going to happen. I mean, it seems like for the mother, I can be a part of this blooming.
Or not.
Or I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, very good.
This is only it.
Yeah.
The last line is puzzling to me.
As most other Midwestern trees turn gray, what is she asking you? I mean, the poet is asking us to. It's a great question. You already asked it. This one's flower. Go ahead.
I think she's referring to the fact that all the other trees are out of season. Like, this tree is blooming out of season. And so it's like, it's like autumn, and so all the other trees are turning gray, but this one's in bloom.
But are we supposed to attach that to people, that turning gray part, as we are with the all the description ahead of that?
If you look at it as you would look at the seasons, I think there's a cycle that those trees will be blooming again at a different time, at what's considered the normal time.
That works. And there are probably other things to bring out, but let's do it then, since you asked. The way to look at good poetry is simply as you make sense of these collected images, see if the sense that you make of them fits the whole thing. And if it does, then that's why they're good poetry. There's more than one or two explanations for it. It doesn't mean by a long shot that anything goes in your understanding of a poem. But it does mean that a lot of things go because they fit, and because good poetry is complex, because the human journey is so complex. But here it is again. Study the blooms and the tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us as most other Midwestern trees turn gray. Who gets paid the closest attention?
The one out of season.
Yeah.
The one that's different.
The one that's different. Mm-hmm. And we can pay close attention with beauty, their beauty, their fragileness of flower, the blooms, the tight buds. Or we can pay attention to what?
Their difference.
Their difference and what the world calls their ugliness and the strangeness. That this poet doesn't let it happen.
I think you could see the contrast of the blooming and the grayness as cycles of acceptance too. Like this is other differences maybe that this speaker has had to deal with. Those things she's come to an acceptance about them and has kind of moved into and put them into part of her normal life.
Yeah.
And that's where their grayness comes in. And this is the thing that's in the forefront right now that she's trying to deal with.
It also sort of affirms the differentness that, I mean, you can't turn around and say, oh yeah, that's what's normal. And that's what the grayness means to me, is that what I should expect right now is just what's happening there. So it just sort of confirms the out of season.
It would have been interesting to hear that poem without the explanation first.
Yeah.
And then when you read, then you read it a second time to do that.
Yeah, that's...
Because I feel like you gave us too much information at first.
And you're right, and I apologize for that. You should have just let the poem stand on its own. It doesn't need me. I'm sorry!
One of the images I liked out of that is the message I got somewhere in there is there's a beauty in the differentness. Mm-hmm.
Can you read the first couple lines again?
I can. All over town, crabapple trees have come out blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. People have noticed, yet no one can account for it. So some have begun to consult the specialists. Others hold that an early frost last spring set the trees in a different course.
She never says I. We assumed it was her journey. It's like she's already journeyed. And the last part of the poem is more of a command. It's an imperative. Study their blooming. It's a really in-your-face poem.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, like,
that's a good literary phrase.
Like, just agreeing with Erica is like, I think it's clear that she's made the journey just from the image that she starts out with. I mean, mm-hmm. She starts out with something blooming, and if it was a journey that she was going on, I think she would have started out with something more ambivalent, you know? I mean, she's starting out with, this is beautiful, you know? And this is something unique and powerful, and it's love and the same way that heterosexual love. You know what I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I think the crabapple tree, though, gives sort of a bittersweet image. Like, it's beautiful, but if you think about the fruit of a crabapple, it's not the most pleasant tasting. In respect, I think that would be reflective of the fact that maybe this was not an easy thing to accept.
Well, you can imagine, without saying anything about this poet, but what we've experienced in this poetry it's not an easy thing to accept, is it? I mean, for the whole world, is, well, we've got to find some explanation for this. We're going to find specialists. Or I got this theory. It was because, you know, dad beat him up when he was a little kid, and therefore he doesn't like, or mom beat him up, or, you know, but the same thing theory here is others hold, well, it's an early frost last spring. That's what caused it. We have to have an explanation. We can't accept the mystery, and which is part of the journey. Whether she's been on it or we're going to go on it, whether it is an in-your-face poem, and in lots of ways it is, and it's also a story of the journey of both the crabapple bud as the person who studies the crabapple bud. There's another one like that, oh, but
could
go
I
ahead.
Say one more thing?
Sure.
The image of the graying trees versus the flowering tree, maybe that has something to do with people who follow the status quo versus the person who is different and chooses differently.
I think that poem is really versatile because I think, you know, I know who she wrote it about, but at the same time, if you just read it on its own, I think a lot of people can identify with doing things in a different way or being interested in things or ideas that aren't the norm and so are kind of outcast in a way.
And the rest,
the bitter fruit in that sense,
her
specific
good.
Situation. Versus the grayness of just
all of us.
Yeah.
Of us. I'm whoever us is, and I'm not trying to include or exclude anybody. Bringing up parents. You, young parent in that city park with your proud eyes following that child over the jungle gym, think of it. She may be a baby dyke, the photos in her baby book forever revealing what you cannot yet name. Or you, with the brown-eyed son who loves costumes, then lives in them, adopts another name for weeks at a time, insists on velvet, sometimes lace. Or the two of you, much-decorated Navy captain and city librarian wife, with the ramrod young man taking all the honors in his class at West Point, yet he seldom writes home, holds his secret so tightly to his chest that if he held out his hands, he might fly straight off. He might fly straight off the planet. So straight-laced this culture, narrow, no room for a gay heart to spread its wings, soar, damage done early. Parents of gay children throw off embarrassment, send with pride the family Christmas photograph with your daughter holding her beloved's hand. New breed of pioneers, their child, much-loved grandbaby, cavorting between them, two wonderful mamas taking their urgent time, bringing us all up. A journey that transcends difference and that creates an experience for us that, I'll borrow Baldwin's phrase, because of the power of art, makes us larger, freer, and more loving. And next, a very different swing, you people of faith. This wonderful book by a parlographist called Barabbas, I'm not sure if it's in the bookstore anymore. Barabbas is the imaginative work of this author, and he imagines what it must have been to be Barabbas, to be the one for whom Christ died. Barabbas is guilty, and all of a sudden he's set free, and Jesus is on the cross, and Barabbas isn't. And in this novel, and it's a great one, Barabbas pursues this Jesus throughout the whole story, trying to find out the Son of God. I mean, the Son of God can't die and come down and preach and walk among people. That doesn't make sense. That's not the God I expect or that I knew about or that I ever thought would ever exist. And he wants to believe in this God, but it doesn't make any sense to him at all, and therefore he can't. And it's a story about faith and the attempts to get faith, but he can't. Well, in one scene, Barabbas has made the only friend he makes in the whole book, and they're not really intimate friends. He just happens to be chained to him in a mine for 17 years. And this guy is a believer, and he believes in Jesus Christ as his only Savior. And in fact, he has on his disc, which on the front says, you are a Roman slave, and on the back it's blank, and his friend, Sahak is his name. That's important because I'll read it in a minute. Sahak, I am not explaining too much, I don't think. But you are right on the other one. Sahak has the inscription Jesus Christ in Greek carved on his disc. Well, somebody turns them in for worshiping, you know, for being traitors and for worshiping false gods and for saying they're being traitors, for they don't belong to Rome, they belong to Jesus. You've carved Jesus' name on a slave disc instead of that. Well, they're caught, and both Sahak and Barabbas have to come before the governor, who will sentence them to death. The governor turned the metal disc over and he looked with evident interest, but with no sign of surprise, at the secret inscription on the back. Christos Jesus, he read, and both Sahak and Barabbas were filled with wonder that he could read the signs, decipher God's holy name. Who is that? He asked. It is my God, Sahak answered with a slight tremor in his voice. Aha! It is a name I can't remember having heard before, but then there are so many gods, one can't keep track of them all. Is it the god of your native province? No, Sahak answered. It is everybody's god. Everybody's? You don't say so. That's not at all bad, and I have never even heard of him. He keeps his renown somewhat secret, if I may say so. Yes, said Sahak. Everybody's god, and in that case he must have more than a little power. What does he base it on? On love. Love. I might interrupt that Barabbas has never experienced love, and that's, in this novel, the vehicle for faith. He's cursed by his mother, he's disowned by his father, he's never experienced love. So it's obvious why he can't ever catch on to what faith is. Love. Well, why not? Anyway, it's no concern of mine. You may believe as you like about it, but tell me, why do you bear his name on your slave's disc? Because I belong to him, Sahak said again with a slight tremor. Indeed, belong to him. How can you do that? Do you not belong to the state, just as this stamp signifies? Are you not a state slave? Sahak made no reply. He merely stood looking down at the floor. At last, the Roman governor said, but not at all unkindly, you must answer this. We must be quite clear on this point, don't you see? Do you belong to the state? Tell me now. I belong to the Lord my God, said Sahak without looking up. The governor stood regarding him. Then he lifted Sahak's head and looked into his burnt-up face, the face that had been at the smelting furnaces. He said nothing, and after a time, when he had seen what he wanted, he let go of the other man's chin. Then he went and stood in front of Barabbas. And as he turned over his slave's disc in the same way, he asked, And you? Do you also believe in this loving God? Barabbas made no reply. Tell me, do you? Barabbas shook his head. You don't. Why do you bear his name on your disc then? Barabbas was silent as before. Is he not your God? Isn't that what the inscription means? I have no God. Barabbas answered at last so softly that it could hardly be heard. But Sahak and the Roman both heard it. And Sahak gave him a look so full of despair, pain, and amazement at his incredible words that Barabbas felt it pass right through him, right into his inmost being, even though he did not even meet the other's eyes. The governor, too, seemed surprised. But I don't understand, he said. Why, then, do you bear this Christos Jesus carved on your disc? Because I want to believe, Barabbas said without looking up at either of them. Is that a powerful scene or what? What do you do with that? To make us larger? Or to create out of the materials of the human spirit something? What's happened to us? What do we know about people who don't have faith? What do you know about, and never mind that question, what translated to? What do you know about Barabbas? who got a look so full of amazement from Sahak. He's been spending 17 years of his life down in the mine with him, praying with him, and then all of a sudden Brabham says, I have no God. Push came to shove. He didn't. Remember, your silence is good, but remember,
honest, though.
It starts with your guts. Do
he was honest, though. When push came to shove, I don't think he totally turned away from God, but he acknowledged, I want to. I'm trying. That acknowledges his humanness and his struggle. And who hasn't experienced that? In difficult times, you know, saying, God, where are you? I want to believe in you. How, that's reality. And I don't think he did turn his back on God by saying, I have no God. Because at the times I think we all experience that. Talk about the human spirit and human experience. I mean, wow.
Do we want to evangelize Brabus?
Well, if you can't experience doubt after spending 17 years down in a mine, I don't know who can.
If you can't experience what?
If you can't experience doubt in a situation like that, I don't know who's allowed to experience doubt then.
Point. What do we know, or what do we feel about the longing for faith? The longing for something certain. When you were little, or when you were big, do you ever say, just a sign. That's all I want is a sign.
Right.
Right? We all do. That's right. If you just give me a sign, then I'm okay.
Yeah. Send a roadmap or a telegram, please.
Yeah.
You know.
We deserve an explanation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wanted something definite.
Or the question that a non-Christian will ask, where was your God when that happened?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you ask the same question, do you?
Do I?
Yeah. Where was... Do Christians ask that question too?
Say the question again.
Where was your God when the Holocaust happened, slavery happened, the car accident happened?
Well, I always feel like God had a reason for it happening. You don't lose faith in God. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that.
I think it has more to do with humans. It's good and evil in humans. We have both parts of it.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just admire this other one. What was his name?
Sahak?
Yeah. For what he'd gone through and was still able to say that he believed in Jesus Christ. And I don't know if it come down to push and shove, if I would really be strong enough to say, like if they said, I'm going to cut your head off.
Which they do here, they crucify Sahak.
Yeah. You know, would I be...
Or Peter didn't.
No. And so, you know, you wonder. I just think it's tremendous, those people that have that strong enough faith that they can...
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, it's certainly an interesting contrast. I mean, both of them have been down there 17 years. Both of them are facing the, quote, heat of the moment. And the one stands very strong in his faith. The other doubts. And I wonder about how that says a lot about my own human experience. At times, I'm very certain in the heat of the moment, quote, very strong in my faith, and other times I feel like, you know, pretty whimpering, fool. Mm-hmm.
Is faith hard?
And because of what that nice gentleman just said, we can't say really that Sahak was the better Christian. I don't feel comfortable in saying that Sahak was the better Christian just because of what he said.
Well, Lagerfish doesn't either. That's a little plug to Read the Book Game. It's a 3-hour read as opposed to Sophie's Choice, which is a 20-hour read. Well, what's again, I don't have to ask that. Taking our cue from the three guys at the beginning, are we larger, freer, more loving? Have we sensed something through the power of an episode of an imaginative writer that brings us into a world that, wow, faith is hard? And sometimes we can identify with that, or sometimes we just recognize that others have it. I surely can't identify with Sophie, who's lost all that she loses, and including her life. I can't identify with that. But what's created in me that wasn't there before is that I love Sophie. Not only what I know about the Holocaust and all that goes on, I've also created, here's an imaginative character that I care about. Something has stirred in me that wasn't there before. It's something I'm contending that something stirs in us every time we encounter something great. We have 2 minutes, so I won't read another poem. I was going to read Robert Frost's Mending Wall. It's just one everybody knows.
Please read.
I'll read it again. You can leave if you want to. You really can, of course. Mending Wall. This is about... Oh, never mind. You're right. This poem can stand on its own. It doesn't need me. But you know one thing that does help, I guess, just that these two guys get up in every spring, and one guy comes over and says, hey, our rock wall between us has fallen down. Let's go fix it. So he walks on one side of the wall, he walks on the other, and they just pick up these boulders and they put them back. And they put this wall back, and they try to figure out why some of the stones tumble, and they think dogs did it or the frost did it. But it's not that. And then here we go. Something there is that doesn't love a wall that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair when they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. But the gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen, to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Well, we're over time.
You said go with your gut.
We've always done it this way before.
And he just can't imagine life any other way. He can't imagine life without that. I don't know why that's taking place.
Oh, it's true.
We've done it that way before. And that ending, I think, really says that. You know, it was there when his father was there. And how many times in any organization, be it an institution of school or hospital or church, or, well, this is the way it's always been done.
You know, a special thing to leave you with on this poem is that who initiates rebuilding it? I say to him, he does.
The author.
The author. The guy who criticizes the other guy's notion of good fences make good neighbors. But I tell him at the spring, let's go do it. We're all caught, aren't we? And so, great poetry, great fiction, with its images and the pictures it creates that stimulate our assessments, erase those already, the assessments that we make, we experience something in life that we hadn't before. And my favorite line out of this would be to you, remember this one, great literature isn't just about experience. It is experience. We participate in ways that we haven't. Let's run off to Vespers, I guess.
Thank you.